You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I am talking to the practically superhuman Deborah Frances White. You may know her from her Guilty Feminist podcast, which she co-created and now hosts with a variety of co-hosts, co-pilots. I don't know even how to describe it. It's an incredibly funny and accessible celebration of women and an examination of the ways in which women can help one another, and oh God, I can't possibly do it justice. It is, it's a really funny, honest, exposing, embracing, celebratory kind of a podcast. And if you don't listen to it, you absolutely should, whatever gender or wherever on any kind of gender spectrum you find yourself. I really, really recommend it. Jess Foster Q and Sindhu V, previously heard on this podcast, are frequent co-hosts of hers. And she is doing some incredible work, not just with the comedy that appears in that podcast. She turns over an incredible amount of stand-up comedy on a weekly podcast, but also in the practical applications that she suggests, the challenges that her and her co-hosts undergo, and the way in which she exhorts her audience frequently to engage in genuine, actual activism. The more I found out about Deborah, as I believe I say to her at the very beginning of this conversation, the more I found out about her, the less I felt like challenging her on anything, because I just wanted to kind of bask in the energy and positivity and optimism and hard work that just radiates from her. Without further ado, this is Deborah Frances White. I feel like we should start with me praising you for being a superhuman, because the more I find out about what you do and have done and are doing and plan to do, the more I go, how is all of this contained within one person?
Sometimes we look at other people and think, how do you do that? But what you must also take into account is that I spent an awful lot of time on Facebook. I'm a numpty and I oversleep. So there's that too. I mean, that balances out.
It does, because then it just feels like, well, you're achieving more than most people in the time available to most people, because you're also sleeping and on Facebook. And
I just think I could achieve a lot more if I worked harder. I really feel that all of the time.
And
I
think, classic workaholic.
Yeah, I think, well, when I was 14, as I've talked about extensively at other times, that I was a Jehovah's Witness. I became a Jehovah's Witness and I got baptized when I was 16. And then all activity had to stop. I was a real joiner at school. Like, I was in the play and the band and the debating team. And then everything had to stop. It was all about knocking on doors and Armageddon was coming and everything would be fine in the paradise. We could make theatre and music and comedy and whatever we wanted. But now Armageddon was coming, the end was nigh. So when I left that religion, when I kind of had this wake up that that wasn't going to happen, that I was in fact in a high control group and I was in fact in a cult, when I had this wake up, I came out and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. Because what the Jehovah's Witnesses promise you, and I know it sounds ludicrous, ludicrous to think that I believed this, and I was academically bright. I'm not, you know, these cults aren't for people who are not bright. It can catch anybody at a certain point in their life, I think, or almost anybody at a certain point in their life if the conditions are right. And so I was academically bright, but I truly, trust me, I really believed Armageddon was coming and I was going to live forever into a paradise. And so when I came out of that and I kind of woke up from that coma, I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. So I've got one life.
And oh, I see what you mean. I'm actually going to, there is no paradise.
There's no eternal life. I'm going to die. Die.
I mean, so you started carpeing the DM.
Oh, I started carpeing the fuck out of the DM. And I thought, well, I've got one life to live. And I've also wasted a number of years now. So what are all the things I'm going to do in this one life? And I always can recognize other people who know they're going to die. Like, I know we all know we're going to die, but most of us, it's just snuck up on us. We've never really looked our mortality in the face. I know sometimes I meet somebody who has that same energy and then it comes out in a longer conversation. They had a car accident when they were young and they thought they were going to die, or they had cancer and they thought they were going to die. It's quite common that people who have a lot of different balls in the air are doing it because they realise their time on Earth is finite and they have faced their mortality in some way or another.
Did you join the Jehovah's Witnesses at 14 through your own choice?
No, not really. I mean, my parents started studying the Bible. We all had to. But I wasn't forced. I was very open to it because I was already quite God-bothering. I was raised in Australia. I was raised in like Home and Away, but with extra God. And so I was already sort of in a slightly happy clappy place. And then, yeah, it was just, your brain is very plastic when you are 14. So it's an ideal time to get into ketamine or Jesus.
It strikes me as well, you specifically said God bothering. So it's not simply celebrating your religion, but it's specifically pestering other people to get on board with your religion.
Oh, yeah. Which makes me an excellent flyer at the Edinburgh Festival. Oh, yeah.
I'm quite a good flyer as well. You've got hustle, but you don't have hustle. You had zeal.
That's different. But you end up, because I was always the same person, I had a lot of technique and I like to have fun with people at the doors to try and make it more interesting, because I found it tedious, really, really mind-numbingly boring, because most people aren't home and the others aren't interested. And it just seems like you're just slogging around, not doing anything stimulating or interesting. So I had to find ways of making it interesting.
It's very hard now to work out if you're talking about Jehovah's Witness door knocking or flyering. There's so many of these things
are
parallel.
So similar. But the other thing is women were not allowed to speak from the platform. In the history of the organisation of Jehovah's Witnesses, a woman has never made a decision about anything, not even what day to clean the Kingdom Hall, not even tiny, tiny admin. It's all done by men. So any secretarial or support roles, all done by men. Women don't get a say in anything. So men talk, and they're trained to talk on the platform, which is like a sermon, you know, giving sermons, that kind of thing. But women are allowed to speak only in two different ways at the Kingdom Hall. One is at the Watchtower Study, when they'll ask a question. So they'll read a paragraph and then they'll ask a question and you're meant to answer with the answer from the paragraph, but put it into your own words so that you have shown you understood it. And so I used to think, right, I will put it into my own words. So my mission at the Watchtower Study, which took about an hour every Sunday, was how many times can I get called by the elder taking the study and how many laughs can I get? And that was my mission. So I used to find ways of making the material funny, and I learned to be really specific, that if you said the supermarket, it wouldn't get a laugh, but if you said Sainsbury's, it would. So I learned a lot of my stand-up comedy techniques, trying to make the congregation laugh in my beach town in Australia. And it really worked and they loved it. People loved it because everything was so boring. And so if I went to another congregation, they'd go, oh, she's here. It's going to be funny today. There'll be funny answers. And the other thing, because you're never more famous than you are, like in your own school or your own church congregation. Like there's a sort of notoriety you can achieve if you have something that separates you from other people. On the Gold Coast, amongst, you know, there's various little congregations of Jehovah's Witnesses, there are probably about 100 people in each hall that would go. And it was a real community because you weren't allowed friends outside of it. I was a pioneer, which meant I knocked on doors full time and only worked for free. So that meant I knocked on doors full time for free and only had a part time job to support myself, so I was broke. So I had a sort of profile within that. And so being funny was kind of my thing that I learned to do. And the other thing I was allowed to do was women were allowed to do these little playlets, little sketches at what they called a theocratic ministry school. And that was where you learnt to knock on the doors in theory. So women were allowed to do these little sketches where you'd write and rehearse on a given theme. And most people did probably two of those a year. And they hated them because it's public speaking. You have to get up and do a little play in front of 100 or 200 people. So I said to the Theocratic Ministry School elder, if anyone drops out, I'll be the understudy. You're going to stay on the night. Just throw me the scriptures and whatever, you know, the theme is, and I'll bang something together. And he was thrilled because if the sisters didn't turn up, he would have to just do a little summation.
Yeah.
So he was like, oh, great. So often, because there were also three schools, there were two back rooms and there was the main house so that more people got to go. So often he would say, I'd turn up on the night and he'd go, oh, I've got one for you. Someone's dropped out because people got mysteriously sick a lot. Mm-hmm. So then I'd throw something together really spontaneously and I'd grab a sister and go, come on, you're going to be the householder. And what I discovered was that the Jehovah's Witnesses found nothing funnier than taking the piss out of the born-again Christians.
Okay.
So I used to make the householder, there's a lot of born-again Christians where we were. So I used to make the householder a quite deluded and not bright born-again Christian. And then I would, through Socratic means, ask them loads of questions and they'd end up talking themselves into a corner.
Explain to me what through Socratic means.
Oh, Socratic, because Socratic means you ask questions until the person realizes it themselves.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So you don't say, Stu, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. You say, why do you say that, Stuart?
Until someone breaks.
Yeah, well, you just keep asking the right questions until they give you the answers that you want.
Sure.
You know, yes, minister style. So I used to find like techniques to make those plays funny, like take the piss out of the born-again Christians. And then I got asked to do those in big stadiums when we did the big conventions. So because they were entertaining and there wasn't much entertaining. And so I started doing my comedy career in stadiums. Basically, I'm a reverse Eddie Izzard is what I am. My first gigs was in a big football
Covent
stadium.
Covent Garden awaits. I mean, I've got a giraffe uni and some handcuffs for you.
That's all I'm saying.
So it seems to me, and that is a profoundly unusual origin story, but hearing it, it's easy to sort of think, oh, if you wanted to create a Deborah Francis White, put a child under this specific set of circumstances. If you wanted to create a comedian, put them under this repressive situation where women aren't allowed to speak, they're not allowed to contribute, give them one tiny narrow funnel through which to focus all their energy.
A pinch of the Handmaid's Tale.
Sure. So why you, though? Why did you react in... Specifically, given that every woman and every girl, presumably in the same situation, the same congregation or fellowship, given that everyone was under very similar pressures, what was different about you, do you think, that made you get the comedy bit between your teeth?
Well, Robert McKee says, you know, the chap that wrote Story about screenplays,
yes.
He says that a character is... He says that your character is revealed under pressure. So... A lot of people want to set up a long time in a film who this guy is or who this woman is. But actually, if you put them under pressure quite quickly, that's when your character is revealed. Mm-hmm. So I think my particular makeup was one that was my coping mechanism. Other people became very introverted. Other people became very maternal. Other people became depressed. And so my particular makeup and personality was one that was going to find a way to get like a dandelion, get through that crack in the pavement and find the sun. And I think that came from, I'd always been a performer. My first performance, I was three. It was my nursery school end of year play. I was a horse. Don't mean to go on about it. Horse number seven. I had a very good costume. And it was all these little prancing horses and then riders behind us. And we were all doing this little prancing dance. I'll never forget it. I remember the rehearsals. I remember everything. And I remember the first time being on stage and seeing the audience looking at me. And I remember the audience clapping and cheering and laughing. And I remember all the other little horses dancing off. And I remember thinking, well, this audience is not done with this dance. And this audience is not done with me. So I danced on and the audience laughed more and I danced on. The audience clapped more. And so I danced on and then until the teacher had to come lead me away. And that was my first ever performance. And it was sort of, you know, always talked about in my family, and the lady who ran the nursery school would always talk about it. She was, she then ran a drama club and she would always talk about it. And I think then that got into my head that I was the kind of person who, and I think a lot of how childhoods are shaped is, well, you're the kind of person who likes to be on stage, and then that becomes true.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And I did though. And then I got in the debate team when I was at senior school. I couldn't run fast or catch balls. And that was, they were the things that were very much prized at my school, but I could talk fast. I could be funny. So I was third speaker and I used to, on the fly, write my whole rebuttal, because third speaker was a rebuttal only. And so I used to write the whole thing. And then I used to do this funny takedown of everything they'd said. And it was all jokes. And debating, which had never been sort of rated at my school, suddenly got, started to get a really big audience because it was going to be funny. Okay. So it was sort of a way of getting credibility and value. And then, so I'd had a few, I think a lot of it is, what have you been validated for? What the answer to why me is, now I'm in this completely stifling situation where I can't make any decisions. I can't go to uni. I can't, my life is going to be completely like drudgery, unpaid drudgery. What have I been validated for before? And can I find a way of doing that here? And I did have a secret underground Jehovah's Witness improv group. I now describe as whose eternal life is it anyway? There was improv was on the telly in Australia. And so I found out there were some workshops happening in my beach town because the people would come from the big city to run them. Big city being Brisbane. Mm-hmm. and so I said to some friends, I was clearly getting quite, at this point, I'd had some bad experiences and I was getting a little bit disillusioned. I still totally believed it, so I couldn't leave it. But I felt the need for something outside, and there's no way we would have been allowed to do that. I mean, it just, the elders, absolutely not. You cannot, it's worldly. So we had to go in secret. So I said to these three friends who were also a bit wobbly, a bit feeling a bit, you could feel the people that were needing something else. And they'd be like, do you want to go and sit up on the top of the, you know, the cliff and look at the ocean tonight and, you know, have some wine or something like that. You know, people who were just sort of feeling a little bit more on the edges. And so I asked them if they wanted to come with me, and they did. And then we got to do the end of year show. And I was a horse. No, I wasn't. I got asked to be a judge at the big shows in Brisbane. So I used to go up, and loads of Jehovah's Witnesses used to come up and watch. Where I used to judge theatre sports at La Pointe Theatre. I don't know how I got invited to do it. I don't know. I must have just talked my way in.
And was that acceptable to the Jehovah's Witnesses?
No. When the elders found out, got stopped immediately. Got banned. But also the funny thing was, is we could never tell the improv community that we were Jehovah's Witnesses when we went and did the shows.
God, so you were doing a double life to both parties?
Because you can't, because firstly, they think you're weird. And secondly, you would bring Jehovah's name into reproach. You must never bring Jehovah's name into reproach to it.
Okay.
Don't do that.
Right. How can I avoid doing that?
Well, if you say you're a Jehovah's Witness, but you're in a nightclub.
Yeah, gotcha.
You shouldn't be in a nightclub, so you've brought Jehovah's name into reproach. So if you are going to go to a nightclub, don't say you're a Jehovah's Witness. So we were in that zone, but they knew there was something weird about us because we couldn't do scenes about sex or anything. Like we were so weird and virginal. So they knew we were odd, but they didn't know why.
There's an interesting element there, I suppose. In improv, it's about, as I understand it, it's about the first impulse, you know, like going with anything. Anything's allowed. And you're improvising under circumstances where there's a sort of set of prime directives in there about things that aren't allowed.
100%. Yeah, you're constantly censoring yourself. So when I left the Witnesses, I was in London. I had to leave the country, basically. And that's when it started to wear off. I stopped going to meetings and it started to wear off. And I had this waking up and I thought, I'm never going to go back to the Kingdom Hall out of guilt. I'm only going to go if I want to. Obviously, never went again. And the first thing I did, I was working as a nanny, and the first thing I did was I found London Theatre Sports and I went to loads of improv classes and I worked with a woman called Patty Styles, who happened to be over here from Canada, who'd worked with Keith Johnston. And when I was a witness, I used to read Keith Johnston's impro over and over again. And that was my little escape. It was a mental escape. So can you imagine if in The Handmaid's Tale, and I don't want to equate my experience with The Handmaid's Tale, but I want to parallel it, but I'm not in no way to give people an insight. If you've watched that, the idea of being kind of trapped and being watched and there being so many rules, but obviously there are some deeply, deeply disturbing, graphic, violent things that do not happen in the Jehovah's Witnesses. Like, so please do not take this the wrong way, but take the spirit of what I'm saying. That when you watch June in The Handmaid's Tale, if she had a book, a secret book that she shouldn't really be reading, because she shouldn't be reading anything. We were allowed to read things, but we were encouraged to read the Bible and watched her publications and really little else. But I had this book, and it was a world of imagination. So I used to like work out, like improvise poetry and things that Keith would encourage you to do on your own. So I would play these games in my head and just on my own, because it seemed like a world into a creative space where you were allowed to make things up.
Yes.
And you were allowed to play, it was a play space.
That book specifically, and I'm not widely read in improv apart from that book really, which I've read several times as well, I always think of that section where he's kind of talking about automatic writing, and you're writing down what you can see in your mind's eye, and if you get stuck, then maybe there's a note in the margin, and maybe there's all ways to kind of free yourself up. That entire book might as well be called Freedom.
Absolutely. And that's what it was. And I definitely knew I shouldn't have it, because the last chapter is about masks. And it's a technique where you put the mask on, you look in the mirror, and you are suddenly inhabited. So you surprise yourself with a different reflection. But the way he writes about that, the Jehovah's Witnesses would see that as demonic. You're opening your brain up for the demons to get in. We weren't allowed to do yoga in case the demons got in while we were meditating.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, it was complete demon territory. So I used to try and avoid reading that chapter. I read that book over and over, but that chapter I used to think, oh, that's demons. But occasionally I would read it because it was so exciting. But that's the space I was in. So when I met Patty, when I did start going to improv classes in London after I'd stopped going to the Kingdom Hall, I met Patty. She'd worked with Keith. She'd been trained by Keith. She'd been Keith's assistant for years. And she is, I think Patty Styles is the best practitioner of Keith Johnston's techniques in the world, including Keith Johnston, because she teaches, Keith is incredible. And if you get a chance to work with him, of course you should. He's the master, and it's, you know, where it all came from. But Patty teaches you, not just the techniques. Mm-hmm. She's looking at you, and she's very erudite. And, you know, Keith's an octogenarian now. Patty's obviously a much younger woman. And she was just brilliant in unlocking me. And it was the opposite of a high control group. So I came out of a high control group into a world of yes and, trust yourself, be in the moment, trust your obvious, stop trying so hard to be good. It was every message that I had had for all those years in the cult was being given directly the opposite message by improv, and I was allowed to inhabit it physically. And it took a while to open me up. It took a while, but I got there, and I recommend that I recommend improv training with the right people as therapeutic for anybody, because we've all been screwed up by this world. We've all been made tense. We've all been made to second guess ourselves and question ourselves, and we're all anxious, and it's the most wonderful, freeing, liberating thing you can do, no matter who you are. No matter what your job is, no matter what your aspirations are, learn to improvise.
So this is Debs. I'm clearly having a ball talking to her, and she has got a huge amount to say. We are going to go into more detail on some of the things we've covered in that first section in just a moment. You might hear in the background some birds squeaking. It's a beautiful Easter Sunday, and I am walking the baby around. Not walking the baby, pushing the baby. And I think she remains asleep. What else was I going to say? Yes, if you are a member of the Insiders Club, or you'd like to join by going to comedianscomedian.com/insiders, you can get half an hour more from Debs. There's the second half of the interview coming up in just a moment. But extras include this week two phenomenal tips on how to... one on how as a comedian she nipped bitterness in the bud, and one incredibly good tip for interview technique. We talk a little bit about her interview for Oxford, the university, of course, and exactly how she obliterated that interview. And it's the sort of tip that you can that pretty much anyone can put into practice if you've got a little bit of spark, a little bit of zing of personality. It's something I wish I'd heard when I was 16. We've got some very good sort of semi-coaching, really, on exactly why and exactly how to create your own model for success as a comedian. So if you fancy supporting this podcast by joining the Insiders Club and getting hold of all of the extra bits and bobs, then the most recent addition to that will be half an hour of proper solid gold extras with Debs. I'm going to let her now advertise her movie because we realised that we'd barely spoken about it. It's coming out on Tuesday, and so we recorded a little extra section at the very end of the pod. This is Debs now telling you all about the movie and where you can see it.
Say My Name, which is my screwball comedy, is on Tuesday night, the 23rd of April. That's tomorrow night. It is at the Leicester Square Lux Odeon. You can either go to the Odeon website or guiltyfeminist.com from the homepage, click through. It's a celebration with Amnesty International, and it will be a celebtastic red carpet. You can have your picture taken on the red carpet after the film. It's a lot of fun. Please come along. Tickets from £10.75, and that's Tuesday the 23rd at the Leicester Square Odeon Lux, and it is called Say My Name. I wrote it and I'm making an appearance, and Sindhu V is also in it, as is Mark Bonner from Catastrophe and Peter Davison, who you may know as Doctor Who. I will see you there. Come and say hi, and I'll happily have a selfie with you or sign your book or pet.
So that's the big take home from this episode. If you are listening to this one on Monday, there is still time to get out on Tuesday and see that premiere in Leicester Square. Also, what else must I tell you? The Guilty Feminist is on tour. Debs' Guilty Feminist book is out now, wherever you purchase books in digital or tangible. Is that the opposite? Analog. Digital or an analog book. You know, a book. So look out for those. Do download her podcast. She's got loads of great stuff on YouTube as well. You can watch her TED talk about charisma and stage fright. And that is a genuinely useful and fascinating piece of work that she has gifted the universe. So more chat from Debs coming up. Thank you to everyone that's been coming out and seeing me on tour. We have pretty much concluded the first leg. I've still got some dates in Soho coming up in May. So please do go to comedianscomedian.com/tour to find out my Soho dates. And also, if you're going to be at the Secret Welsh Festival, I'm performing in Eplas, which is an absolutely mammoth room. So please help me fill it. Sold lots of tickets, but plenty more still to go. I think it is. It's one of those things that is, if we all believe in ourselves, I can just sell out that big room. But God, it's big. So I believe in it, but I'm going to need your help. If you're at the Secret Welsh Festival, please do come along and see End Of. I cannot wait to perform at that beautiful, beautiful place. Right, that's that. Next leg of the tour is on sale as well, but it doesn't happen till autumn. And my Edinburgh show is officially on sale as well. It's called Primer. It's a work in progress. It's 3 p.m. daily at the Monkey Barrel. Two consecutive days off in the middle, so do double check. I think the Monkey Barrel website is called thefringe.com, cheekily, or possibly even thefringe.co.uk, not sure. But the company I'm keeping at the Monkey Barrel venue is absolutely extraordinary. I'm very pleased to say I've already managed to pod a good chunk of them, but they are some of the great and good of, I don't know, is it, I mean, it's not a genre, is it? But, you know, have a look at the website, see the kind of acts, and you'll go, oh, wow, it's all those kind of guys. And I'm very, very proud to stand among them. I'm using guys there as a non-gendered way, as is my wont, which on this particular episode sort of clangs a bit. I say guys, okay. Check out those people. Can we find a non-gendered guys? Because I don't consider guys gendered, but I realise it's not up to me. So if you have suggestions, at ComComPod on Twitter, a non-gendered, worthwhile, fun way of effectively saying guys, in which it will embrace everyone. And I tell you what, this has cropped up before as well. What are people saying instead of ladies and gentlemen these days in order to include everybody? I'd love to know what you're saying and what you think works and doesn't work. Tweet at ComComPod or join the conversation on that on the Facebook group. Which you can join. Normally I get round to adding people within 2 or 3 days of requesting, but we are keeping that a very beautiful and safe and friendly piece of the internet, so please join in there. Right, that's all of that, Gubbins. Let's get back to Deborah Francis White.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
I have emails, which I have kept. One which says, and this was at a time, I need to say, this was at a time when I had my own Radio 4 show, which I'd got myself with my name in the title. So I thought, well, now, surely, it's only a handful of people a year that get their own show with their name in the title on Radio 4. And that sort of gives you a sense of, you know, the landscape of British comedy, lots of people who get on the radio, get on the telly, that kind of thing. So I thought, now, well, at least they'll come and see my show. Nobody needs to represent you, and they may not get you, and then they shouldn't represent you. But I thought, well, definitely come and see the show now, the live show, because I've got my own Radio 4 show. And I needed someone to do the deal, to do the contract. So I thought, well, I've got something to bring as well as 10% or something. And I remember getting an email from an agent saying, which I might frame, saying, I cannot consider anyone of the female persuasion. That might sound sexist, but it's not. It's the industry that's sexist, it's not me. The industry will only take a certain amount of women, and, you know, I already represent some women. And I wrote back and said, but we are the industry. I'm a comedian, you're an agent. If we're not going to change it, who is? Like, we can't wait for this other industry that isn't us. And I got another email saying, we're a bit saturated at the moment, girl-wise. And I remember reading this going, female persuasion.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, that's like, the I've biggest red flag, isn't it?
Persuaded to be female. And I think she was being arch. Because, yes, listeners, it was a woman who wrote that. Of course it was. None of the men wrote back. At least she emailed. But it was the female persuasion. She was being arch. She was being wry when she was saying. She was trying to be playful in her language. But it hit me in the chest. Female persuasion. And I was like, my God, no one could persuade me to be female right now. If I could be persuaded to be male, I definitely would. No persuasion needed. But I remember those emails coming in, and what they were saying was this thing, the only thing you can't change about yourself, you're doing the work, you've got, you know, I was doing this show about my birth mother that was very, you know, funny and poignant, my best work ever I've ever done, of anything I've ever done, I think. Truthful and authentic and, you know, all of those things.
This was Rolls the Dice.
Yeah, it was the original, like the Half Can of Worms, that one of the shows that inspired Rolls the Dice.
Gotcha.
And it, you know, and I don't say that about all my shows. Some of my shows have been mediocre. Some of my shows, one of my shows was quite terrible, I think. And some of my shows have been very good. You know, like everybody who's done a number of solo hours, you've got, you know, you usually there's a spectrum there. But that was the best show I've ever done. And I knew from the response of the audience how good it was. And I couldn't get them to come and see it. And the thing, it wasn't like, well, we'd be looking for someone who's more of a club comedian, which I can change. It wasn't, you need to work a couple more years, which I can change. It was, you are of the female persuasion. We are saturated girl-wise, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I remember sitting in the bath, just crying and crying and crying. And then, you know, talking in the pub, getting quite bitter about not having an agent and how, you know, how screwed up the system was and how unfair it was and what more could I do. And I also had this improv show that I was directing, with lots of big name people coming along and saying how great it was and how could people not see, and how could they not see, how could these agents and blah, 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 blah. And I heard someone else doing it. And I went, wow, that does not sound great. That sounds like somebody somebody should be compelled to represent you, that you're owed a career, that because you've got A, you should have B, that that this model of agent and client is the only model, that you can't see beyond that, and that your life, where you've got a Radio 4 show, which lots of people would kill for, is somehow not good enough because you don't have what someone else has. And what you're not looking out the window and seeing is somebody who's picking up rubbish for a living. And are they complaining that they don't have a Radio 4 show and a platform to air their views and tell their stories? No. They're not expecting what you've got. Stop expecting what other people have got. Keep doing the thing you're doing or change it. And find another way to get what you want if it's important to you. But sitting in a pub railing to other comedians that what you have isn't good enough is so unappealing. And you are not owed it, no matter who you are. You are not owed it.
There's an interesting relationship there between entitlement on the one hand and a kind of righteous anger that you are entitled to a fair go.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, what I did then was to change the model. And I think more and more women and other marginalised groups and intersections of the two are changing models now. We're breaking the model. And so because it was perceived at that time, and this was said a lot, I had a lot more coded emails as well of, we have to consider what the industry will take. And that meant not women.
Mm.
And the guilty feminist is a microclimate for success for women. I write about this in the Guilty Feminist book, that it is a place where when I say, and tonight my co-pilot is Jessica Foster Kew, or please welcome to the stage Alison Spittle or Sindhu V or Bisha K. Ali or Susan McComb, the audience acts like they are at a rock concert. They are just like, oh my God, it's Susan McComb. Oh my God, it's Bisha K. And they freak out. And then you see those women come onto the stage. You can't not respond to being treated like a rock star. You just get a bit bigger. And a few women have said to me, God, this must be what it's like to be a man in a regional comedy club. There's the expectation of who we were hoping for. You know, yeah. Oh, my God, we were hoping for somebody who looks like they're on Mock the Week. We're hoping for you. But it is actually a more powerful tribal feel at the Guilty Feminist because women are thirsty. So thirsty for entertaining content that's also intelligent. They're so thirsty for someone to come out and say what's on their mind, but in a funny, joyful way, and sometimes an angry way. Sometimes it can be an angry, funny rant or an unfunny, angry rant. You know, there's space for all of that on the show. But that show has, I mean, I've been very fortunate that what I wanted to say hit a zeitgeist. That's all you can do. All you can ever do is authentically go out and say what you want to say and then hope that the world wants to hear that. And that's how you find an audience. I've been very lucky that what I wanted to say here, zeitgeist, but nobody says to me now that the industry won't take women. And nobody says to me now, I can't consider anyone of the female persuasion. And part of that is by no means just the guilty feminist, but the guilty feminist is part of a landscape where women are demonstrating, oh, there's an audience for us. There's a huge, throbbing, thirsty market. And sounds a bit rude. And we are employable and we are marketable. And the things that we have to say, there is an audience who wants to hear them. So I never hear that now. But partly because those same agents are now emailing me going, oh, is there any chance I could get so-and-so on the podcast because there's a tour coming up? And they understand that if people come on the Guilty Feminist audiences are so proactive, you know, they leave the house. They love to leave the house, the Guilty Feminist. They want to come out. They want to be part of something. They want to be part of this tribe. And they are so supportive of the act they see on the show and they hear, or they're so supportive of the acts they see if they come out live or that they hear at home when they're listening to the podcast. And they get devoted to comedians, you know, and there are people that routinely do our show who are booked for very little, if any, television. I can't understand why, because they are just evidently some of the best comedians in the country. But they have followings. People will come out specifically to see them. And one of the comedians said that she was in Scandinavia supporting a big named act who was a white man, and she was a woman of colour. And she said this Swedish kind of comedy booker could not understand why there were all these young Asian women there queuing up to meet her. They were like, who are you? Because we've got Mr. Big Name. But they said they were so excited because they'd seen, they said, we saw the poster and we were like, oh my God, she's in town. She was then signing autographs and doing selfies. And the booker was like, but who are you? You're just this person that's come along to open. But I suspect there were more, there were as many, if not more fans for her than for him, because women are thirsty. This booker, which is the local comedy club, wasn't booking any women. So they never got to see anyone that represented them, much less any Asian women. So they found her through podcasting. This is the thing. The internet is this great place where you can find your tribe. As many problems as there are on the internet, wow, that is an incredible thing. So this idea that the industry will only take so many women, that's been blown out of the water now by, as I say, the Guilty Feminist is only part of the landscape. There's many, many, many other podcasts and YouTube channels and live nights proving otherwise.
When you talk about the audience of the Guilty Feminist, the listenership, and how they react, they love leaving the house, they love doing this, they love supporting. To what extent do you think they are their own thing and the show reflects what they want? And to what extent do you think that their Guilty Feminist listenership-ness is a reflection of what you set out to achieve?
It's a circle. It's really a circle. There are some people who were like, oh God, we've been saying this for years and here is an entertaining play space. Because a lot of what women are offered is cocktails and shoes. And listen, Sex and the City was very important in its day. It told women it was okay to talk about sex and at brunch and not be ashamed. So to take nothing away from that show, which was an important development for women in its own way, we are at a point now where we are not interested in sitting around just talking about our own careers and our own love lives. You know, some women do love cocktails and shoes. I love cocktails and shoes, but I want to be sitting in the fabulous shoes, drinking the cocktail, talking about how we can change the world, and then getting on the work boots and getting out the water bottle and going and doing it. I love femme things and I love dressing up and I love going out. I love all those things, but it's not enough. Not now. Not now. And it reflects my privilege that it ever was. And I feel that some women have said, you know, I've done a book tour and so I got to meet a lot of people because you sign every individual book. So sometimes you're signing books for hours. And lots of people you meet very kindly tell you what the podcast has meant to them. And I've learned a lot from that. And a lot of women have said, I didn't think I was a feminist, or I didn't know I could be a feminist, or I didn't think I was good enough to be a feminist, or I didn't know what feminism was. I didn't think I liked feminism. And I've come to it through this podcast. And that's by no means just me. That's every single woman who has come onto that stage and done some stand-up comedy, sat there and had guested, every activist, every you know, actor, scientist, you know, expert, author who's come and sat there and shared in that conversation in a joyful space. Because the other thing we're offered as women, apart from cocktails and shoes, is it's all going to be very difficult for you. And now here's someone to explain why you have to be twice as good as a man to be considered half as good. Bad news on the pay gap front, worse news on everything else. And then it's depressing. There's no jokes. And bless Woman's Hour, which is amazing, you know, in many ways, there's no jokes on Woman's Hour. So if they're going to have someone come on and talk about something, it's not going to be funny. We had an episode about Nazanin Radcliffe-Zaghari, who's, if some of the listeners don't know, an Iranian British woman who has been wrongfully imprisoned while visiting her parents in Iran. She's a North London mum. And she went home to visit her parents and she got wrongfully arrested. And Amnesty International are trying to get her out. And on the podcast, we had Richard Radcliffe, her husband, Tulip Sadiq, her MP, and then two people who are creating a show about her. And, you know, we're still campaigning with Amnesty to get her out of that prison. So I said to Alison Spittle, who's one of the funniest comedians I know, I said, Alison, I've got a problem. Like, this show is going to be, like, so... The second half is going to be so sad. And The Girls from Mars is a comedy show. So we have to... So we never do... The theme would never be imprisonment or anything like that because it's a comedy show. So the theme could be the patriarchy or the theme could be resilience or something like that. So I said, we have to pack the top of the show with so much funny that when we come to this second half, we can take the tragedy and the sadness of this story. So I said, I've got it. Okay, fine. So we did this really funny I'm a Feminist Bart, some... really slammed the stand-up comedy. I mean, and that's why I really wanted Alison, because she's just so funny. And so the audience were really, really, you know, we'd given them so many laughs. So when Richard came on, I was like, it's okay now if this is sad. But the thing is, if it had been Woman's Hour, and again, no disrespect to Woman's Hour, that's amazing, but if it had been Woman's Hour or another forum like that, I just can't imagine any other forum where Richard Radcliffe would come on and there would be some jokes. Because of the sadness of the situation. But just because of the nature of the show, we can tone shift so quickly, like gears, and the audience will go with us. And I remember just a couple of things, which is one is we were asking Tulip and about the night that it happened, and she's Richard's MP, and she said, well, I just had a baby and I couldn't walk down the stairs. So I had this baby on my breast. So I had to call Richard to come to my flat and to call Jeremy Corbyn. And they came up and I had my tits out. I had my breasts out. No, I was breastfeeding. She said, I had tits out. She's an MP. She said, I had, because I was breastfeeding. So I was there with the baby on my breast. And Alison just leaned over into the mic and said, that's the ultimate power move, isn't it? Sitting there with your breasts out. And we were just sort of imagining this sort of Jeremy Corbyn on the one side and Richard Grafton on the other. And this kind of became a running gag about Jeremy Corbyn and getting your tits out. And there's another point where Richard said he was talking about meeting Boris Johnson for the first time. And Alison just kind of leaned in and went, what does Boris Johnson smell like? Because I've always had him down as a Davidoff cool water kind of guy. And just things like that, that we can do, that would never be on any other kind sure. of forum. It's just such a joyful thing to be able to do that.
And you are the architect of that. For all you are magnanimous about, it's the sum of its parts, all of these fabulous women, all these people that get involved and everything they bring to it, you're the architect of it. You've constructed it. You've created that space. And you have decided that it be, from day one, it was your show, and you decided that it be the sort of thing you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I started the format with Sophie Hagen, and we kind of, you know, we created it together. And Sophie... about 9 months in, wanted to go off and do other stuff, which is, you know, and she has gone to do lovely other stuff, brilliant other stuff. And then I then got to shape it more, you know, one person always has, you know, you end up sort of shaping it more around your own vision. I always think there are some times when I'll do a joke and my particular audience will respond in a certain way that I know that joke will make them go shocked or make them really laugh. And I always think comedians create audiences in their own image.
Mm-hmm.
Like we are like, in some ways, the way you shape the people who will come to your show are those who respond to your work.
Yeah.
So you end up playing an audience that almost no one else could play. You know, in some ways that everyone knows if they come into the Guilty from a space, what the parameters are. We just kind of intuitively know. So I've seen comedians do a routine in a club and they've done the same routine on The Guilty Feminist and they just sort of slightly tweak it.
Yeah.
They might leave out something that they might do in a club that they think the audience won't like, or they'll add a bit, which gives it a more feminist perspective, which the audience will like. So we are all the architects of the space. And I think, but yeah, I mean, of course I've created the play space I want to be in. I've created in my own image. I've created it with my own, I've written it in my dream journal and I've made it happen. And that's the great thing. That's what you can do now because of the internet. You can write something down in your dream journal and go, I'm going to make that. And nobody stops you. That's what I always say. Podcasts are radio that nobody stops you making.
Yeah, I've got 100%.
And I keep waiting for an email going, that's enough now. It never comes. You can just keep making, and we broadcast every Monday at noon, every week of the year. When we first started, the first year, it was every 2 weeks. And from year two, every Monday at noon, like it or not, want to hear it or not, The Guilty Feminist is coming out, including Christmas. And what a joy that I'm not waiting for someone to commission 6 more, 12 more, 20 more episodes. Just make them whenever I want. And that's, you're agile as well. You know, you meet someone in a pub, as I did last night, you know, and talking about, you know, sex workers. And I was like, well, I want you on the show. You know, let's make this happen. Again, you know, if you're working for somebody else, you're working for a network, you have to get a sign off and takes years. And, you know, this. And am I allowed to do a book or am I allowed to do can I do this on ice with a rock concert? You know, we can do whatever we want, whenever we want.
You refer to the listeners as your army.
Yeah, or our army. We're an army together. I don't see myself as the leader of an army, but more like I found my army. Like we
you found
are
your army.
Yeah, there are people, there are leaders, there are all sorts of leaders and inspirations. Like I found Scarlett Curtis, I found Kara Sofoco, who does Level Up, Scarlett Curtis, who does Pink Protest. I found artists that I never would have found. I found Nikesh Shukla, who does The Good Immigrant, who is, we have men on the podcast because it's not just, as Bridget Christie says, it's not just a women's job to solve sexism. The same way it's not black people's job to solve racism. You know, we have, and Nikesh was coming on and talking about, you know, The Good Immigrant, which is a sort of similar venture in book form for people in this country who are immigrants or the children of immigrants, and the way that that they're marginalised and oppressed and told they've got to fit in or they've got to live up to a higher standard than a white person, whether they're an immigrant like I am or somebody who might be fifth generation British. So there is clarify, a person of colour may well be many, many, many generations British as well, but they'll still be in some way seen as an immigrant. So I found so many people who I suppose have started or engaged with or found themselves in the middle of similar movements at the same time. And I feel like one of the joys is this movement is happening and we are sort of almost accidentally part of it or at the forefront of various parts of it. And what a joy and what a privilege. And it has taken me out of myself. So that response that I was talking about sitting around bitterly talking about not having an agent, that's gone because I'm like, oh, you know, I've got lots of lovely agents now for different parts of my career and I'm very lucky, but I just don't think of the world that way anymore. I'm just, yeah. My own career is just the least important thing compared to what we might be changing now.
Have you become more of a feminist since starting making the show?
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I feel in my skin I have more permission. The whole show is about, the ethos of the show really is that we don't have to be perfect to be a force for meaningful change. And I think what was often holding me back before was the idea that I'm a feminist, but here's my secret hypocrisies. And that's the cold open, how we always start the show. And it was actually Tom Selinsky, the producer, who also happens to be my husband, who made that the cold open. So we played that as a game in the middle of the show on the very first episode.
Okay.
Sophie and I played it as a game where we thought, because when we were meeting for lunch and talking about these things, we were confessing these things to each other. So my first one, the first one I ever did, is probably still my favourite, which is true. They're all true. I'm a feminist, but one time I went on a women's rights march and I popped into a department store to use the loo and I got distracted trying out face cream. And when I came out, the march was gone. And I thought first, oh my God, I think I'm going to get kicked out of the feminist club. But of course, so many women were like, thank God for saying that, because yes. I just went, oh my God, my feet hurt and I hate crowds. Oh, I'm just going to pop into this pub to use the loo. And actually, while I'm in here, I might just have a check of, well, upload these photos to Facebook. And actually, while I'm here, I should have a pint. And, you know, our imperfections, we often think, well, I'm the only one. And, or our aspirations for more, where we find ourselves falling short of some, you know, ridiculous standard we've set ourselves. We then, that can feel then like guilt, and guilt, if held on to, if not exfoliated, turns into shame, and shame is luggage, you carry it. And then you think, can I speak up in this meeting? can I ask for more? This isn't right. He got paid 50 quid for that gig and I got paid 35. I should say something about that. But if you're carrying this sort of weight that I don't think I'm actually that good a feminist, it holds you back. Shame causes inactivity. You think I'm not able to say it because of, I'm such a hypocrite. So when the idea of the guilty feminist is we put those hypocrisies on the table and they're often very, very funny. One of my earliest ones was I'm a feminist, but I often have sexual fantasies about being dominated by famous fictitious misogynist Don Draper. And I truly believe that if I met him, I could make him whole and heal his pain. And that's that kind of thing. And so many women go, yes, but you know, if you're thinking, I don't think I'm a very good feminist, because how would I be thinking that? And also then going, yeah, I agree. I'm a feminist, but I've often agreed with other feminists to get them to like me.
Yes, okay.
All of those things. So when you put that on the table, they're funny, they're really good comedy, but we also can either laugh at them, go, that doesn't matter, or if it does matter, let's work on it. Let's get it out on the table and build muscle and get beyond that.
They have a unifying value, don't they? You say that on stage in front of 1,000 people in the Barbican or whatever, and everyone goes, woof, yes, we feel like that as well. We're unified.
Exactly, except it's 2,000 people in the Barbican.
Does the existence of the guilty feminist mean that that space has kind of been occupied now? Do people have to create further different models? Like in the way that podcasting has gone nuts at the moment.
Mm.
So do you see other feminist comedy podcasts rising up?
I mean, I'm sure it's a bit like saying, you know, we've got a television show with a continuing story about a family and the people next door. So there'll be no more of those then. But you've got Corrie and you've got Emmerdale and you've got EastEnders. And, you know, like, I just think whenever it's women, it's like, we've got one of those. We've got a female-led project. You know, people are finding different ways to express themselves, finding different angles to express themselves. So, you know, we do a show called Global Pillage, which came out of a guilty feminist challenge. When we first started, we used to do challenges all the time. And because of the amount of output, I tend not to do so many challenges anymore. But it was a challenge around sort of be the change you want to see in light entertainment. to paraphrase Gandhi, that I thought, instead of just complaining that panel shows don't have enough women on, what if I created a diversity-based comedy panel show? So I created a format which was two teams of comedians versus the hive mind of the audience. And because all the questions are about cultural diversities, they can't be about whales or volcanoes like on QI. They have to be about how people live. So it could be idioms. You know, in Colombia, they say you're swallowed by a postman's. You're swallowed like a postman's sock. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. So that's great fun for the comedians to riff around. But after the comedians have answered, then we throw it to the hive mind. And anyone from the hive mind of the audience can shout out, but then the hive mind has to get behind one. So they buzz like bees to get behind an answer. Okay. So everyone gets to play, even if you don't shout anything out. And we have a teams round. So the players have to be diverse to some extent, because otherwise, so you might get somebody saying, well, my mum's from Jamaica. And when we grew up, she always had a saying that, you know, or, well, my, you know, I'm from Scotland and, you know, there's a certain sort of, you know, something you do at a wedding there that involves a toaster.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't, listeners, there isn't. But you have to have diverse comedians. And the hive mind nearly always wins because diversity works. And 100 people will always know more than any two. So even Paul Sinha's played a few times and mm-hmm. he is a quiz master. He's like in the top whatever in the world. He hasn't beaten the audience. Sometimes comedians do, sometimes. But mostly there'll be someone in the audience who spent a summer in France or someone else who's from Denmark and et cetera. And our audience has gotten way more diverse because people listen to that podcast at home and they hear someone in the audience, because in the teams around the audience have to offer questions as well. So they've heard a woman in the audience say, I'm from Iran. And there we have a saying, I will eat your liver. What does that mean? It's nothing on that podcast for me to be the only white person. It's nothing on that podcast for us to have no men at all, or You know, it, you know, everybody LGBTQ, or it's not, it must be totally normal. So that is about facts. Now you might say, well, no such thing as a fish has got facts covered. It's got unusual facts covered. No need. So the real estate that was available in the podcast world was not in the same territory as what fish are doing. You have to then create a new territory. But I didn't go, well, there's already facts on the internet. There's no need for facts. You just go, my drive is not really facts. It's about people. But facts is a conduit here. So interesting fact about, you know, I remember Sindhu V saying, I'm Indian, my husband is Danish. Why did he have to bring flip-flops and an umbrella to our wedding? You know, that kind of, you know, what's the, and then everyone, great comedy fodder. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you are learning about how people are different and how people are the same.
And are there copycat podcasts of The Guilty Feminist out there?
I think copycat's a bit strong. I don't think anyone else is doing, you know, definitely there are studio podcasts where I hear, you know, similar riffs, or, you know, they'll start with a similar cold open or something. But I think that's kind of an homage, and it's flattering and it's nice because it feels like, you know, if it's inspiring other women to find a voice and speak, then that can only be a good thing. That can only be a good thing. Like it's definitely inspired more women to podcast. And if I didn't want that, what kind of feminist would I be? To go, oh, no, there's only room for one feminist podcast. Feminism is about women taking up more space. There are millions of male voices that are broadcast on official channels. The internet is a space with no gatekeepers. Women, speak up, find your voice, speak on. And I would say the same for men who are in any of the intersections of marginalization. I have a lot more privilege in many ways than many black men, many Asian men, a lot more privilege in certain ways. I can just run up to a building thinking, oh God, I'm 10 minutes late, run through the door. I don't have to stop and go, is there a disability access? Mm-hmm. So I'm not in a wheelchair. So I'm cisgendered. I don't have to worry about my gender identity, you know, matching my gender expression or my assigned gender at birth. So there's all sorts of ways in which I am privileged. So if you are a man, and even if, you know, you might think, oh, I'm a straight white cis man, I'm not allowed to talk anymore. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Find something relevant to say that people want to say at the moment that's really in your heart to say, and find a unique way of saying it, or a, you know, work on your craft so you become the best storyteller or gag writer about how men are feeling right now, and you will find your audience. I think a lot of men now are feeling kind of, ooh, this is a new landscape. We were the norm, and now, hold on, now we're, you know, as Hannah Gadsby says, now we're a category. Straight white men didn't used to be a category. This is a new world for us, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're being told about toxic masculinity, and we're feeling a bit othered. And yeah, welcome to the world
for everyone else, yeah.
But explore that. If you're feeling upset about that, without just sort of railing and saying everyone else is wrong for saying it, explore what that feels like. Talk about it. You'll find an audience. You will. If you talk about it with entitlement and bitterness, you will find an entitled, bitter audience.
And there are quite a lot of entitled, bitter people out there who are prepared to be that audience.
And if that's straight white men, I will say it. If you speak about it only with entitlement and bitterness and with no self-awareness or perspective on how other people may feel, that's the audience you will find. So if you want an entitled, bitter audience, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. If you want an audience that is questioning, that is wanting to grow, that is seeing this as an opportunity for structural change that might make the world for better for you as well, because you've got, you know, oppressions and you've been told I'm not meant to show my emotions, or I've got to fit into this category or that category. You know, if you're coming to a place from a place of change, well, Jonathan Regan's doing a podcast called Men Behaving Better, where he's exploring these things, you know, and he's had some really, I went on it and I found it really interesting. And, you know, so I'm saying, whoever you are, find a truthful thing you want to say, work on your craft. Are you funny? Are you analytical? Are you a storyteller? Would you like to be any of those things? Find an authentic conduit for it that you feel, you know, is in your wheelhouse. or lift the weights and work on, if you're not funny, lift the weights, work on being funny, you know, work with funny people, you know, and say what you want to say and you will find an audience. It might not be a huge audience, but you'll find a devoted audience, and that's better.
Are you the most powerful voice in UK female comedy?
I don't think so. No.
Who else is more powerful than you?
Oof. God, this is like inside the actor's studio now, isn't it? I think, well, I can think of some women right now. I wouldn't like to do a rating system because I think there are many powerful voices in many different ways. I would say Catherine Ryan has an extraordinarily powerful voice, and a lot of, on the face of it, might look like she talks about the Kardashians a lot, but actually, you go to her comedy show, my God, there's a lot of feminism in there. There's a power in there. Her routine around Hamilton, and I love Hamilton. I'm obsessed with Hamilton, but her routine around Hamilton is so brilliant, and it's not really having a go at Hamilton so much as having a go at men in powerful positions. In men in powerful positions abusing that power over vulnerable women. She's railing against Alexander Hamilton, the man, more than the musical. But my God, and she's criticizing the musical a little, and my God, she is doing it beautifully and brilliantly. And so she reaches a mainstream audience that might never find a podcast, much less my podcast. I would say Sarah Millican has set out a stall that has created an environment where it is completely normal to be a woman on the telly. I would say Sindhu V has just sailed in, and just through sheer talent and assumption of inclusion, Sindhu assumes you will include her, and then you do.
Like, yeah, totally. Yeah.
She just says, I assume the seat is at the table is for me. And you go, oh, I must be. You know, she's the kind of person that if there was a plasmont there and it didn't say her name, you know, it was a bit of card, she'd be like, well, this is a mistake. And I love that about her. And I think, you know, the way that she has sort of sailed in and spoken so brilliantly for and about a part of our society that, you know, a whole chunky minority of our society that is not normally reflected in mainstream comedy spaces, but then in a way that is relatable to every single person who has a mother, child or relative of any sort. I would say that Sarah Pascoe has done something for women with this crossover of comedy, science and analysis that's never been done before. I would say that Desiree Birch is bringing all sorts of intelligent conversation with them, you know, incredible ability and talent in comedy. So I think there's millions of people I'm leaving out, and there's millions of movements. I mean, Bridget Christie, look what she's done for feminism specifically. And I think more so we're seeing that now. Mae Martin has got a Netflix show, you know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, you know, what Fleabag has done and what Chewing Gum has done and Michaela Cole and Susan McComb now writing stuff. So I just feel like it's a landscape. And the idea of a power hierarchy doesn't really track with feminism, because I feel like it is really my privilege to amplify voices. So, you know, if I'm the only white person on The Guilty Feminist, it's always the best show, because I suddenly hear and understand things when women of colour talk to each other that I have no insight on, in the same way that a man has no real insight on what it is to be a woman. But if he sits, if he hosts something where he's the only male voice, which is so rare, what was normally done is four men, a woman on the end, four white people, a brown person on the end. And one night I remember this really compelling show where I had Rosie Jones, who's gay and has cerebral palsy, Ellen Jones, who's on the autism spectrum and is gay, and Kima Bob, or is Ellen bisexual? I can't remember. She's queer. And Kima Bob, who's pansexual and neurodivergent. And they talked about going out clubbing. And how do you, as, you know, if you're feeling like you want to dress up in a femme way, as opposed to a more masculine gender expression. How do you signal in the club that you're interested in girls and not guys? And, you know, Rosie Jones saying, everyone knows I'm disabled, nobody knows I'm gay. And Ellen says, well, everyone knows I'm gay, but nobody knows I'm disabled. And this conversation that happened and the way they analysed me and my... They analysed me as heteroromantic and bisexual. And it's so interesting. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing. I'm learning so much. And the only thing I regret is I said anything, because I should have just not said anything.
Is there a point at which the apex then no longer involves you?
No, because I think I am the... Of the guilty feminist.
Of the guilty feminist.
I don't think so, because I think the thing I bring, which I understand the value of myself in that way, is that ability to kind of create a warm space. Sarah Bonetto, the comedian, mm-hmm. said to me years ago, you're brilliant at hosting and bringing people together and making people feel good in the space, or like they belong in the space. And she tried to produce a show, which was just like me doing a chat show, late night Leicester Square Theatre. And we could quite, at that time, it was a great show, but we couldn't quite get it off the ground. We couldn't quite find its sort of reason to be. But what she'd identified cleverly was that I was a good host and I could make people feel like they belonged somewhere. And I think that's my role, is to make people feel... not just included. The whole thing with diversity and inclusion is, you're different, we've included you, what more do you want? In the corporates, it's, you've got an email account and a lanyard, you are included, now get on. Making people feel like they belong, making people feel celebrated, and making people feel like rock stars, that's a different skill. And there's something about that space, I think it is partly that I genuinely do feel it. When I say my co-pilot for this evening, that's always how I introduce, if you come to a live show, how I introduce my co-host. When I say my co-pilot this evening is Susan Wilcoma, I genuinely love her. I think she is a queen. She's hysterically funny. She's not a stand-up comedian, but she's come and done, she does stand-up when she co-hosts. She just does it. She just tells a story about, you know, being raised in a Nigerian household and bailiffs coming to the door or something. It's an incredibly funny story. Or we did one, the first time she ever did stand-up was we did one on makeup. And Susie talked about her first sitcom out of RADA. She was very young. And she said everyone was like running their lines and bonding. It was the first day. She was like, oh, it's exciting. I'm making a sitcom. Studio one with the studio audience. And the producer came and got her and said, would you follow me, please? And she went down a long corridor. She thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be fired. And they took her into a room and said, we're really sorry, but we can't light you. Because most people in sitcom are white and there's one mixed race and you're just not showing up on the light. You know, we just don't know how to light you because you're a dark-skinned black woman. So we're going to have to paint you a lighter shade of black. And she was like, what? And so she said, everyone else is out there bonding. And she said, I am in a room being slowly painted like Avatar. In what she called a reverse minstrel. And she was so funny about it. We were very shocked by hearing the story, but also, of course, she managed to make it very funny at the same time. That was the first time she'd ever done stand-up, and it was this incredible story. But the thing is, that's what you learn if you say, not we will include you, you get to sit in on our conversation and talk about what it is to be black. No, it's when you come on and you are one of the architects of this space, you are co-hosting and this is your stage. Now you talk about makeup through your experience. You don't have to talk about being black. You're talking about makeup. And that's where you learn about your privilege, because that's never going to happen to me, because the makeup is always right for Caucasian skin and the lighting is always right for Caucasian skin. She said, I wouldn't do it now. I'd just say, make the lighting guys work it out. It's the lighting guy's job. It's not my job to be less black. It's their job to be good at their job. She's very young and didn't thought, oh my God, I guess this is what I have to do. It's TV. But that's, I think the bit of the guilty feminist is, I mean, of course, if I, you know, I could give it to someone else and at some point might, and at some point, you know, if I fell under a bus, I'd very much want it to go on and already have planned the memorial episode.
The hubris of all podcasters.
I know who would do it. I've had a word. Obviously, there's a will. I hope that a small pool of my regular co-hosts would keep it going. And I hope Tom would keep it going because I think it means a lot to a lot of people. But I think while I'm alive and keen to keep working, I think that's the bit that I'm doing, which is when Susie comes out, I am genuinely in awe of her. I adore her. We make great eye contact. We have so much fun. And then whoever the guest is, I can make them feel like they're part of that party. And it's knowing what your skills are as well. Sometimes I really love doing stand-up on The Guilty Feminist. I have to write 9 hours of stand-up a year, I've worked out, to do The Guilty Feminist, which is ridiculous. Sometimes you obviously think, oh God, I've got that dinner party story. Sometimes you have to write something from scratch. Sometimes I get a bit desperate, read something from my book or find another way of being funny. But most of the time I just have to write a bit of stand-up and hope on the night. I've started doing new material to hone it a bit. I've got a bit better
at previewing the material before doing it on the show.
Yeah. Okay. I try and do that now. And when I do that, it's always much better. When I have a go, I do have a new material night, which is great. But often I've got somebody on who, you know, is hosting a few times a year. So they might bring a bit of the most honed bit of their show. And then I'm sort of riffing about something and trying to find the funny, you know. So I am well aware that sometimes I have a good night doing stand-up and other times I'm riffing until we find something funny and then Tom leaves the funny bit in the edit. You know, I'm well aware of that. I'm well aware that for stand-up, I am often not the funniest person on the podcast. And I am absolutely fine with that. I genuinely sit in awe of watching Felicity Ward just tear up that stage. My God, she loves being on The Guilty. She does laps of the stage like Victoria. She just loves it. It's like being at a rock concert. You know, it's that celebration. And she is ridiculously good. Jessica Foster Kew, honestly, I think she's one of the best comedians in the country. I honestly can't. She's just consistently, achingly funny. I can't understand why she's not on every TV show all of the time. Honestly, I can't. Alison Spittle, as I've already said, you know, Kima Bob, who's a young new voice, and I've platformed Kima a lot because she's a voice we need. She's African-American, she's pansexual, she's neurodivergent. She has so many perspectives in one human being that we need to hear right now. My God, do we need to hear them? That is a voice, and she is funny. Funny, 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 funny. So I think, you know, listen, there's so many people I'm not even naming who are just brilliant, have brought so much to the show. If you're listening and you have not been mentioned, it is no reflection. I can't read out every single name. But honestly, I feel like the bit that I'm doing, and I always love the riffing. I always find the funny in the riffing with the other comedians. And, you know, I always love that part. But I feel the most important skill that I bring is that making this a playful, safe space of deep belonging. And by safe, I don't mean safe space. I mean safe space to play, to confess, to be vulnerable, to be angry, to be proud, to all of those things in a funny and entertaining, joyful way.
Are you happy?
Oh, I'm so happy at the moment. Yeah, I'm really happy. I'm overworked, but I found a purpose, I think. And that's extended out to, I've been asked to be an Amnesty ambassador. We're doing some incredibly exciting work together. I've been doing a lot with Help Refugees over the last few years. I've got to write a book, a Guilty Feminist book, which I've got to really, you know, consider my ideas. Very hard writing a book, but, you know, can really, you know, put those down. I'm working on a play at the moment in development with a big theatre. And I've now got this opportunity to express myself in any manner of ways. And I've got this incredible community, you know. I've known Hannah Gadsby for so many years. And, you know, to be able to discuss my work and her work with her is such a privilege. You know, it feels like I'm part of a community now. And I think the thing I always used to feel is I'm an extra. I'm a hanger on. I'm not central to anything. And I think now I've sort of found my purpose and found my space. And if you feel like that, if you feel superfluous or extra or like, no, you know, I'm not central to this, whatever this gang is. And I think everyone feels it, to be honest. I think when you're in Edinburgh, it's so easy at the Edinburgh Festival to feel like you're, no one really wants to hang out with you, or you're not important. You go into the performers bar and you don't know who to talk to. I'm sure everyone feels like that at times. So, you know, if you feel like I'm not central to this space, make a space that people want to come to. Make it. Nobody is stopping you making that space. If you have time to be at the Edinburgh Festival, then even if you create in the performance bar, if you invite someone over for a drink, if you say, have you met so-and-so, you can be a conduit for connection. Then you are at the center of that. That just by definition, don't stand on the wall waiting for somebody else to include you. Include yourself and then include others.
So that was Debs. Thank you so much to her for coming along, for having me in her makeshift recording studio. Thank you to Tom Selinsky of the Spontaneity Shop for assisting me with the record there and letting me borrow all his gear. Thank you very much to Nathan Wood for editing and uploading the show. Thanks to Jake Crossland for logging, and everyone else who has been a part of the process for this one. I really enjoyed talking to Deborah, and I am sure that you, having listened to that, are going to seek out everything she does. She is just absolutely replete with fascinating ways of seeing the world, with optimism, energy and hope. So please track down everything she does and engage with it to your heart's delight. Right, I think that'll do. I'm going to quickly post-amble at you in a moment, but for now, I think that concludes the podcast. Thanks for all the love on the Chris Addison episode. That was a belter, wasn't it? And everyone, hey, listen, I want to make clear, the Chris Addison extras for the Insiders Club, there is a little bit about why his essay writing show technique wasn't necessarily the best way to do it. So many comics have said to me, and non-comics actually, in the last week, so many people have said, oh, wow, that Chris Addison essay writing technique for writing shows, that's superb. And it is, and it was very successful for him. But in the Insiders Club, in the extra stuff, he does make a very good point about why that isn't necessarily the best way for everybody to write a show. So before you, I know it's a crucial time of year, before you radically change how you're prepping for Edinburgh, do give that a listen if you can. Okay, that's all for now. I'll speak to you very soon. Next week, Matt Bronger, the last of the South by Southwest episodes. And holy hell, it's hard to think of a warmer, more friendly, funnier person than Matt. So I hope you'll enjoy that one too. See you then. So just a quickie post-amble today. As you can hear, there's beautiful tweeting in the background as I stand here in a bit of a beautiful forest on a lovely spring Easter Sunday. A spring Easter Sunday, as opposed to those wintry ones we sometimes get. I just wanted to thank a couple of people in particular, one who contacted me via email and one who came to the show, a lady who came to the show in Oxford, neither of whom I will name. I just wanted to say thank you so much because, you know, it's kind of a, like, okay, this podcast satisfies very many things in me. I love comedy. I love comedians. I love championing people. I love kind of archetypalizing people and going, oh, this person is like this person, you know, and all of those things. I also love when you get in touch to tell me that the show is affecting the way you look at your mental health, which many of you do. I don't think I am doing a Ronnie Cheng style tooting of my own horn here. That's not to say he does, but he just used the phrase, I don't want to toot my own horn, about 50 times in our interview. But I'm proud of this, so I'm briefly going to take a moment just to underline this fact. A young lady came to see the show in Oxford and waited around afterwards, as some people do, to say hello. I'm always very happy to meet people afterwards and attempt to flog them analogue merch. This lady was very nervous and shy and actually physically trembling and looked like she almost wasn't going to say hi, but I kind of, we made a little space to say hello to each other, and she let me know that listening to the podcast has given her the confidence that she needs that therapy is a thing that exists and that all sorts of apparently powerful and happy people do and engage with, to the extent that her chronic anxiety, which has been a huge part of her life, she now regards as something that there might be help with, and that she has started going to therapy in some part because of this podcast. Now, you know I always defer to John Darnell from the Mountain Goats on this one. When I saw him at a gig and someone shouted, "You saved my life!" And John Darnell said, "No, I didn't. You saved your life. I was just what you were listening to while you did it." That's one of the happiest sentiments I can think of. So I'm not trying to claim credit for anything here. I'm just trying to gently reinforce the message. One of the brilliant things, I think, about this podcast, to toot my own horn, is that people can use it as a space to be vulnerable. And people who are apparently, you know, stand-up comedians are some of the most powerfully, apparently powerful, socially powerful members of society. And yet you listen to them on this and you realise actually they're pretty vulnerable and wobbly, and a lot of them have been to therapy or considered it. And a lot of them, people are often saying, you know my theory on this. People say, "Oh, you know, stand-ups, they're all depressed, aren't they?" And I go, no, everyone's depressed. It's just stand-ups have a platform to tell you about it. Your postman might be depressed, but you never get to find out. So if you are someone who is listening to this and thinking, "Oh, you know, maybe I have got some problems, but therapy wouldn't work for me," just take a risk. Do it for me as a favour. Just take a risk and go and get an appointment on the NHS if you can, or if it's desperate and you can afford it, which I know not everybody can. Just try one little private session, or someone might do you a half price one for a starter. I don't know if therapists do that. I feel like they did years ago when I first started. It's just a talk with someone who doesn't judge you at all. It's just a talk. It doesn't need to be anything more invasive. It doesn't need to be as full on. Some people I know, I have a very close friend who for a long time wouldn't go to therapy because he thought, well, if I just start telling all the stuff that I think and that I feel, it's going to be like a tap that I can't turn off. All that stuff will be out then and I'll be feeling terrible about it, and then the hour will finish and I'll have to leave. I mean, to a certain extent, that's a risk you take, but I think there's more to it than that. And I think even if some of the stuff you're thinking is very deeply buried, I saw there's a great meme about this floating around, as memes do, on the internet, where someone, I think it's a bunch of plates inside one of those crockery, you know, like a thing you have in your kitchen which has glass doors on it, and normally your plates are all racked up in it, but it's clear from the photo that all of the plates have fallen over, and as soon as you open it, they're going to go everywhere. And I think the meme is, someone on Tumblr said, "Oh, you know, this is like my mental health." And someone said, "Yeah, that's exactly why you've got to open the door. You can't leave it there forever. That stuff is going to come out. A lot of it's going to shatter, and then you can rebuild, get more stuff, sort yourself out. You know, you've got to open that little cabinet door at some point." So if the idea scares you, please try and draw some solace or strength from the fact that lots and lots of people on this show and lots of people in your life who you may not even know it about them have tried and found great success from talking to people, whether that's in a financial professional context or just simply ringing someone, an old friend you used to have great chats with, and saying, "Hey, can I bend your ear? Can I just talk out loud? Because I've got some problems," and you don't need to do or say anything. You just need to listen. Or the Samaritans, or anyone. You would be amazed. You might be amazed. Some of you won't be amazed because you know it's good and it works. But you might be amazed at how much better it makes you feel. So thank you to that young lady that came to the show in Oxford. And thank you as well to the guy that emailed me to talk to me about his relationship with his wife and how the podcast has been useful in helping him convince her that she might find it useful and that maybe there's nothing to be scared of in seeing someone. And apparently that is going well as well. So thank you very much to both of you people for putting that in the forefront of my mind in the last couple of weeks. And I hope that anyone listening to this who is, and I stress this isn't to do with Deborah or any of the content of this episode. As you'll know, if you're a regular listener, I just like to kind of ramble about something after the show. But that's the theme today. Talk to people, please. And if people in your life are saying, "Hey, you might benefit from therapy," and you're going, "No, I don't think I would. I don't trust it. I don't like it," give it a chance. It might work. That's all for now. I'm going to push Future Girl back home in this buggy. I think she's managed to sleep through my soft, flat Midlands droning voice. She managed to fall asleep even though her little toes are bare and poking out, and I didn't think it would work because I thought they'd be too cool. Oh, one of them just moved. Right, I'm getting out of here. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.